Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 305. Should you understand the entirety of your code base? How familiar are you with Python's built-in functions? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week with another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. We discuss a recent article by Sean Godecki titled In Defense of Not Understanding Your Code Base. We dig into the differences in scale of software projects and the factors that can obscure the understanding of the complete code base. We also cover how opinions and practices people often argue for are based on the development strategies from decades ago. Christopher shares his recent video course that explores Python's built-in functions. The course is divided into sections to help you find the right built-in for tasks involving math, data types, iterables, and I/O. We discuss which of these functions are frequently used in our code. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including recent releases, querying with F expressions and Django, replacing if-else chains, a Rust-based replacement for Python's JSON module, and a couple of Python cheat sheet resources. This week's episode is sponsored by HydraDB. HydraDB is the agent-native graph database. Just ingest and connect your most important tools, and HydraDB automatically builds a context graph. No query language to learn. Try HydraDB for free at hydradb.com/signup. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher, welcome back.
Hey there.
Well, we got our usual lineup of topics and news and projects this week. You ready to dig in?
Yeah, let's do this.
Okay, well, I was given a mission to create a piece of music for our new segment. It's not going to let me change the settings here. Well, you're going to have to just be able to tell me when it's done. Because you'll hear it, I won't hear it. Okay. All right, so here you go. Enjoy.
Here's the news, your Python news. There's nothing to do but enjoy the news. Christopher's Python news.
Wonderbar.
Does that work?
Yeah.
All right, well, I might make another one just for fun.
Well, speaking of the news, if I was going to make you guess what the first thing I was going to comment about, would that rhyme with Shmeta? Because, yep, Python 3.15 beta 4 is out. This is the last planned beta release, which means the RC must be just around the corner. The next bit of news is a couple of PEPs. First, PEP 838, which is titled Adding Python-Version to PyVM CFG. When you create a virtual environment inside the directory, there's a file called pyvmconfig. It contains a series of names and values that describe the environment, one of which is where the environment lives, for example. This file isn't quite as standard, and different tools store the information about what Python version is being used in different field names. CPython's VM has version, virtualenv and UV both use version-info, and if that's not bad enough, all three of them store different values inside of it, sometimes just the version, sometimes including other information from sys. It's all over the place. So essentially what this PEP proposes is standardizing on a name, which is Python-version, and a value, which is major, minor, and patch number. So this is another one of those standards that we hope the tools will adopt, but nothing that is really enforceable, change the language kind of stuff.
I wonder how related it is to the virtual environment discovery thing.
Yeah, I suspect as they're having those conversations, they're bumping through other little things on the road and going, this is a mess as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
The other PEP is 840. Not sure what happened to this one, but it appears to have originally been numbered 837 at some point. So the first time I saw it was like the rename, which is weird. But anyways, so regardless, the title is Name Resolution in Class Namespaces. This one is a little tricky. Evidently, there's an inconsistency in how global and local variables get addressed when used as part of a class attribute. This is kind of hard to describe over audio, but there's a corner case where you use a global variable to assign a class attribute, and a subtly different case where what looks like the same code results in a local variable getting used instead. This has to do with the rules outlined in PEPs 227 and 3104, so that's part of the whole 2-3 transition. Not only is this a little confusing, but the correct behavior can't be determined statically, which makes it hard for tools to reason about. The PEP outlines a few different approaches to fix this problem, none of which seem to come with a glowing recommendation. There isn't a paragraph that says, and we will do it this way. It's like, this one has this problem and this one has this problem. I'm reading between the lines a little bit, but I think the idea here is to foment more conversation amongst the core devs. We'll see where this one actually goes.
Yeah, Guido is involved along with Jeremy Hilton.
Yeah. This is one of those things that I didn't even think, you know, I don't think it's something I've ever done in my code, but anytime you run into that and it doesn't behave the way you expect, that can be weird. So yeah, consistency in the language is useful.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that gets us into topics. My first one is a piece by Conwell Marine on kdnuggets.com. It's titled Stop Using If-Else Chains, Use the Registry Pattern in Python Instead. It has a subtitle, Learn a Cleaner, More Extensible Way to Dispatch Logic in Python. And this might have come up before, but I think it's a good example. It has really good code throughout to show you what the ideas are and different ways to approach it, going from simpler to more advanced as you go. If you're using if, elif, and else statements for matching cases, it can start small in your code base, but as time goes on, it can grow more and more as the cases get added. And soon you got potentially like 100 lines of if and elif, and it becomes really hard to manage and also for you to follow along through the logic. And so Conwell's arguing, yeah, it may work, but it breaks. It also doesn't follow what's called the open-close principle, where software entities like classes or modules and functions should be open for extension, but closed for modification. So the idea there is like extending to have more cases, but not necessarily modifying the core logic under it. And so he has a better solution. It also stacks unrelated logic into a single spot, something like a payment dispatcher function that covers credit cards and maybe PayPal and a pay later system, something like that. Each would have little to do with each other as far as sharing a single function, and the elif ladder forces them to be together logically. And it scales poorly. Getting to like 20 branches is going to be hard to scroll through. And each time you look at it, if you're looking for like a single one of those branches that you want to debug, it can't be extended externally. So if you were to import this in, you would have to either do some forking on top of that or monkey patching. The logic would be sealed, so you'd have to actually go into the main code to adjust it. He has the suggestion, which is to use the registry pattern. It uses a centralized lookup table that maps keys to objects, which can be, those objects could be like a function, a class, or an instance. Each object would normally in this process register itself, and more on that in a second. For Python, the data structure is often a dictionary, keys and values. You pull up a key and return a value. And again, the values can be like a function or a class or an instance in this case. And you can use decorators for the registration. That's what we're going to dive into a little bit later after this point. The article digs into several examples. The first example shows just setting it up with a dictionary. It creates a model registry dictionary with abbreviations for keys. In this case, he's using a different example that's kind of from more of a data science background with models. Like the abbreviation might be logreg, And then that would be for logistic regression. And random forest would be a random forest classifier, an SVM or XGBoost, same kind of ideas. And you could see in that example at the top, defining the dictionary with all the different versions of things that you want for the models, you could simply add another one in there and it would still look pretty clean and make sense. The function that's below it has get model and then the name that you're asking for, and that returns the model. And then it has some error handling with a try except block. So it's kind of a nice little clean piece of code example to give an idea of how you might set it up initially. You'd have to manually maintain adding the more models in the dictionary, but it is open for modification in a very readable way. The next example shows how to use the decorator that I was mentioning before to have the components that make up the registry, they would register themselves. And this is something that one of our very elaborate tutorials from Ger Arna about decorators, he has a whole section about plugin architecture, and it kind of follows a very similar concept there. So if you want another resource for that, I'll link to that. So he defines a function, register, and then uses the @register for each item. In this case, it's back to credit cards and PayPal and other kinds of payment things that he's registering as functions that it would call out to. The piece moves into how to create something that's completely reusable then, a registry, like by putting the logic into a class, and then shows code of not only how that would work, but then if you wanted to reuse that and use it as a way to replace the boilerplate you would have to write each time, you could use this instead. And in this example, he's using a text processing pipeline, which I think is another good example. And an extra thing it accomplishes here is then reordering the pipeline or adding different steps in the case of something like text processing is actually pretty easy. You could say, oh, I want to have this and then that and have it kind of flow between them. He wraps up with places where the registry pattern comes in handy. Again, plugin architectures, I mentioned that is something that's covered in a Ger Arna's thing. In that case, you could like add something to a folder and it might have the programming so it adds it automatically. You've seen this probably before in web framework routing, something like Flask, where there's the @app route and then the different locations you want to go to. Or maybe you've seen something in a sister project to that, the Click project, where you have an @cli.command. Those are both registries in disguise. You could also use it for like file format or parser dispatch, so you could map extensions for, oh, we're handling CSVs or we're handling JSON or Parquet or something like that to loader classes. There are some considerations, though. Like the first one that I thought of right away was like, well, you know, a lot of if-elif statements might be about ranges. So it's not going to work for something that's like greater than or less than and equal to. Or if you're doing something pretty straightforward, like just switching between 2 to 3 cases, it might be cleaner just to leave it as an if, elif, else kind of thing. But if you want something that, again, is a bit more extensible where there are going to be lots of other cases added, I think it's really neat to kind of show what's possible. He also advises that you want to show people what is available, expose the keys, and you know, put into your error messages what's available. What he means by that is like if somebody runs into an error, you want to be able to show all the different values that are in there. So he shows a little bit of code for having that happen. And the other problem you might run into potentially is you got to be careful not to override a key with the same name. It's a plain dictionary, so a duplicate will disappear the original. And that might be fun to troubleshoot. So thanks, Conwell. Is your AI struggling with context and accurate retrievals? Pure Vector Search is relationship blind. It grabs the nearest embeddings and stops, with no sense of how facts connect. HydraDB is the graph database built for agents that need to reason across information, not just fetch it. Relationships are first class, so your agents traverse the connections between facts instead of guessing from proximity alone. Power agents that reason over context, user personalization, and company brains. Sub-200 millisecond recall. RBAC safe. Fully managed with native integrations for 100-plus applications. You can try out HydraDB for free at hydradb.com/signup. What's your first one?
My first article is called Nifty Django Feature F Expressions, and it's by Tim Schilling on his Better Simple website. You've probably heard me talk about how Django has an abstraction layer for talking to the database called an ORM. You define a Python class, setting attributes inside of it, which then map to columns in a corresponding table in the database. You can then run methods on the class to perform operations on that table, like creating, reading, or updating a row. So I'm going to use an example out of Django's docs. Say you have a class called Reporters, which tracks the name of reporters at your newspaper, as well as how many articles they have filed. You would run a get specifying the name of the row that you're trying to retrieve of a particular reporter. And then if you want to update the number of stories they've filed, say they've just recently filed a new one, you would do a +=1 on the stories filed attribute. Then call the save method to have the updated record written to the database. So this takes two database queries, one to get the object, then a second to update the object after the attribute has been modified. Django's actually lazy. That's not an insult. It means that database queries don't actually get run until their results are required. So for example, I could filter all reporters whose names begin with B, then filter the result for all those who have more than three articles filed. When I do this, a query hasn't actually fired yet. I'm just chaining these things together. When I go to access the result, that's when the query fires. So this allows you to create increasingly complex queries, but only having to fire at the end, which is nice and efficient. So the example I just gave takes two queries because I access the attribute, which triggers the first query to happen. So I look up the reporter, I access the attribute, that actually fires the query. I get the reporter object and its attribute, and that's what gets me the number of stories filed. Then I increment that locally, and then I have to save it to write the record back, which causes the second query. So as you can imagine, this isn't particularly efficient. We're doing two queries to do a single update in the database. And it really doesn't matter in this simple case because it's not going to make that much of a difference, but this can get slow for larger, more complicated queries. So Django includes something called the F expression, where F stands for field. And you can use an F expression in many of the places you would normally use a field. And when you do, the result is a modification of the database query. So a better way of doing my increment example is to get the reporter object like before. Then instead of doing a +=1 on the stories filed attribute, you set it to an F expression that names the field. You can then add one to the F expression. So by creating this F expression, you're not actually accessing the attribute yet. So no query has happened. You're registering with the database query that you're going to do something more complicated. Then when you do the actual save, the newly constructed query that happens gets sent down to the database. So essentially what this means is one query fires to update the row, and you don't have to do that two-step process. So Tim's article introduces you to F expressions. He covers several different use cases, starting out with how you use them to read data. So for example, if you want to query all rows where the value of one column is larger than another column, rather than bringing all the data down to your server, then looping through it, you can run a filter using an F expression saying this column has to be greater than the F expression of this other column, essentially moving all the logic into the database. Another handy use is with models that reference other models with a foreign key in the database. You can use the F expression to traverse this inside of the database query, again, saving you from having to pull the data down from the server. The final section in the article is on using F expressions to write to the database, which is where I started with my attempt to explain all of this. So if you're writing Django, knowing when to use an F expression can mean a big difference in your code's performance. Tim's got some great examples here that help you see all the different ways that that could be helpful.
Have you been using them?
I use them on occasion. Most of the work I do with Django is very, very simple. From a database query standpoint, it's a fairly simple thing. It's almost always get the object, do something with the object.
One-to-one kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's a lot of, most of the stuff I do is very sort of vanilla business form pieces. This is one of those that I kind of try to remember, leave in the back of my head that this capability is a possibility, but it's not where I start. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of for, Django can be used for so many different things. I could think of it as like, if there's a large library of articles or things like that, where you're having to do true querying, you know, it could save a lot of effort there, I guess.
Yeah, I think part of it is, like, I'm also not really a database guy. Like, I know enough SQL to get to be dangerous. And I think if you've got a deeper database background, you'd be like, well, I can do this in one query. Why is it making me do two? And so then you're like, then you might go looking for it.
Yeah.
Whereas because I'm much more an object-oriented programmer, I almost always, it's like, oh yeah, whatever. Oh, this is going to take three queries? Ah, whatever. Who cares? And it isn't until I actually start seeing performance issues in my code right. Where I'm like, oh, okay, now I got to go figure out how I do this, right? I know there's other ways of tackling this problem. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So my next one is from Sean Godecki. I think we featured him before. It's on his site, seangodecki.com. It's titled, In Defense of Not Understanding Your Code Base, which is a little misleading. We'll get back to that. It has a first line, as a software engineer, how well do you have to understand your own code base? And the primary concept he's conveying is there are different sizes of code bases. And if you were to work on a standalone project, something like a video game or even like a tool or maybe like a database program or something like that, that standalone product or code base is something that you probably could wrap your head around. So it all kind of makes sense. But he argues that, you know, there's a lot of people that don't work in environments like that. They work in much larger environments. And we always talk about architecturally what's happening. But if you work something like a big code base, like all of GitHub or Google Web Search, I think about banking systems because I've worked in that. Tie together everything from mortgages to credit cards to servicing to checking just as like regular bank operations and so forth. And so it's going to be real hard for like a single person to understand all the logic that's going inside there. And so people will work inside these different areas. I think the thrust of the piece, you know, an individual would know their own area and wrap their head around that potentially. But I think the thrust of the piece is diving into this online narratives about programming in general that out there in the world, people say you need to understand your entire code base, but they're coming from an aspect of, well, what is the size of that? And comparatively, and so he wants to kind of say, hey, if you work for a large corporation and you work in these larger code bases, there are things that get in the way of that. And so he has two arguments that he has for that and ways of programming that have different methods and practices and cultures. I'll quote it. However, the first group is overrepresented in online discussions about software engineering. I want to defend the second group against the first. In many software engineering environments, there's nothing wrong with being in a state of partial understanding. In fact, in large systems, a partial understanding is the best you can do. And he starts continuing to argue that the concept of understanding your code base comes from a historical context. Peter Knorr wrote a famous paper, Programming as Theory Building. And it encapsulates much of, with this core premise, when programmers write a program, the code is a byproduct. What is the main product is their theory of the program. It is made of their intuitive sense of what and why things are happening. And the program is only a representation that doesn't completely capture everything in code or documentation. So in that case, if the programmer had to start over after losing the code for some reason, they could rewrite it. If they didn't understand it, like an entirely new team replaced them, they would have a tough time recreating it or making sense of what the code was. So this need to understand everything that's happening. He provides another quote from the paper that takes the point a little bit further. Reestablishing the theory of a program merely from the documentation is strictly impossible. Therefore, the existing program text should be discarded, and the new form programmer team should be given the opportunity to solve the given problem afresh. And Sean's point is, if you are a software engineer at a large company, you know that that's dead wrong, that you're not going to be able to recreate it. And he gives two real key points here. You can't rebuild large systems from scratch. Large systems that have users contain thousands of what I would call edge cases, which have been handled over time. And that's written into that code base. And he shares how successful rewrites of a system start by dividing the code base into isolated chunks and then work on them one at a time. He writes, In other words, rewriting a software system involves making a bunch of changes to the old system. If you can't change the old system, you certainly can't replace it with a new one. And the second point he has is about abandoned systems. He's experienced this where, like, there's been mass turnover. These tech companies have like a huge code base and no one's familiar with that particular area due to turnover. And the system's still running, but nobody's really maintaining it. And he's experienced this firsthand and taking the time eventually to go through the entire thing, one flow end to end, and then slowly branch forward. He argues that in a very large code base, everyone operates with an incorrect theory of the program, which I think is interesting. I don't know if incorrect is, you know, there, but it's definitely not. I don't know. I gave it this idea that sort of the three blind men and the elephant. This person who works in this area, like the blind man touching the leg, is like, oh, I think it's a tree, you know, and I think that's what he's kind of saying here a little bit. You know, the person touching the trunk is, oh, I think it's a snake, and et cetera. It's like, okay, you understand this portion, but you don't understand the whole picture of what's happening. It's too big to fit inside your head. You can understand what's happening just in that section of the code that you work on. He does point out that Nar wrote the piece in 1985. Average programs were several orders of magnitude smaller. If you were around, if you're working in the home area, most programs were distributed on floppy disks, which were around 1 megabyte.
Or the back of magazines.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Typing them in yourself. I know the RAM memory sizes of personal computers in 1985 were usually in the kilobyte range. And so I had to think about it because I didn't work in any of those kinds of conventions. What was the memory of a mainframe back then? And so I looked up a large system. IBM had this one called the 3090, and it had 128 megabytes of central storage and 128 megabytes of expanded storage. Was water cooled? And you want to guess the price?
Seven figures.
$5 million.
Yeah.
In 1985 dollars, which would be $15 million today. Yeah. So, yeah.
I did some work on a 3090.
You did? Okay. Yeah, but I mean, you know, 128 megabytes, like, you know, we think of like flash drives that are much larger than that. So wrapping your head around thousands of lines of code is possible, hundreds of thousands, maybe 200,000. But he gives an example. In 1987, the first version of a compiler, GCC, was 100,000 lines of code. The 2015 GCC, there was over 14 million lines. So at that point, it's going to be really, really difficult for a single person to understand everything that's happening in. And he digs a little bit into our current conversation, the idea of LLMs writing your code. We've talked about the deluge of like trying to review that code and understanding what's happening. That he feels LLMs are a double-edged sword there. They make it harder to construct a detailed mental theory of the software, but they allow you to build a partial theory quickly, and they can help you leverage the partial theory more effectively. But that's a complex trade-off that he's still thinking about. And I agree. I'm having a lot of these conversations with people coming on the show to talk about agented systems and building stuff and ways that you can construct your theory in advance to give the program. And he doesn't want to have this become all about LLMs. He shares several other things that can get in the way of you maintaining a theory, other people writing in your code base. A common thing people deal with today is implementing legal requirements, things like data protection and accessibility. You might literally bring in somebody as a specialist to help you with those things or outsource that type of thing. Turnover, which is all throughout this whole article, or just literally individuals moving to other teams. Patching things for security across different versions. And then something that you didn't think about in 1985, at least I don't think so, is using libraries and other dependencies. Can you wrap your head around that library that you're importing in also? So it comes down to scale. Maybe the title should have been had the words all of in front of the code base, then it would be, maybe it wouldn't have been as enticing as a title. So
this is also a strong argument for good architecture, right?
Yes.
You can only keep so much in your head at a given time. You're going to hit a limit. And the more you have to think about large chunks, you need to be able to do that in abstractions. So if I can think about it in, you know, 6 or 7 large chunks, and I don't have to think about what's inside of those chunks, just how those chunks are interacting, I can keep a pretty useful model. And that, and I think that's what he's talking about with that, the all models are wrong, right? There's kind of that thing in engineering, which is like all physical models are incorrect, but that doesn't mean they're not useful, right? So
yeah.
And so like you can understand the whole system at the modular level, but then be an expert on one of those modules. And as long as you keep those boundaries nice and clean, you're fine. When you start traversing those boundaries, then
yeah,
you're expanding what you have to understand, which makes it more difficult.
He has some really interesting notes at the end of the piece. First, he talks about how programmers who do work on these large code bases sometimes really like to work on other projects in open source. They can see as more fun, less stressful, and feels like real engineering because they're completing this entire thing and then sharing it, and it all makes sense to them and so forth, and they can accept pull requests and make sense of what's being added or pulled and so forth. And then he had some edits to the tail of the post, which he had shared it on Lobsters and Hacker News, and people responded. One comment pointed out the ability to reason locally about code has been a core goal of computer science from the beginning, with a partial understanding. And that makes sense. And then the top Hacker News comment is a genre of comment he gets a lot, which is basically, wait, this situation sucks. Why isn't the blog post about how much this sucks? And there's a lot of posts like that. And he hopes that it will fill another niche. He feels like he writes in a way these sort of vocabulary explainers for people that want to know the kind of like what their tech leads and line managers are talking about, like what they're speaking about in this kind of situations. And he feels like that's important. And, you know, people pushed back against that. But like, I agree. I mean, that's something that why we have these kind of discussion things on the show, is that there's a lot of terminology. There's a lot of stuff that, you know, and a lot of people are coming into the industry, especially now, that maybe don't have that CS background and don't, you know, haven't read those papers and so forth. But anyway, I think it's great to define these types of things. What has been your experience? You've worked in a few situations and shops that have had pretty large code bases, I believe.
Yeah, once you get past a certain level, you can't fit it all in your head. And there's a age thing that goes with that as well. And I don't mean my age and my fleeting memory that is decaying as we go by. I mean the age of the code base, right?
Yeah.
And that kind of touches on, right, like he's talking about the turnover, right? So
right.
The longer the code's been around, the more likely there are more people who have touched it, the more likely there have been weird little use cases. Long surviving code, particularly at scale, tends to end up being kind of by definition a square peg in a round hole. Somebody will come along and go, you know, if it had this feature, this client would buy it. And maybe they do, and maybe they don't, or maybe they do and they're the only ones who use it, and maybe they're no longer a client. Right. But no one goes back and gets rid of that code,
yeah,
right? So like bigger code bases tend to have this sort of organic kind of algae, swampy, whatever you want to kind of, you know, whatever you want to go down.
Cruft, I think, was a term people liked.
Yeah. Bit rot. And you have to, this is kind of part of what dealing with all that is, right? And like when you're presented with a new code base, like if you're dropped into a project like this, like the first thing, you're never going to understand all of it. So you have to sort of carve out the piece and try to understand what that is and how to work with it, right?
Yeah, or even like you said, like the human element of like, oh, did I write this code?
Oh, yeah.
And trying to reread it and understand what's happening inside
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
You know, I now have a code base that goes back, you know, 7-8 years ago, and I'm like, oh yeah, okay. You know, it's going to take you a little while just to get up to speed on it again.
Yeah. So the longer it's been around, you know, there's nothing like coming back 6 months later and somebody going, can you add a feature to this thing you haven't looked at in 6 months? Yeah. And
yeah,
it might as well have been written by somebody else.
And let alone if it's like a framework you haven't been using in a while, yep, or something like that. Yeah. All right. What do you got up here next?
Well, my next bit is self-indulgent. It's my latest course for Real Python, and it's called Exploring Python's Built-in Functions. It's based on an exhaustive tutorial by Leodonis Pozoromos. Both the tutorial and the course cover all the functions that come with Python that don't require you to import a module in order to use them. So you may have heard Python called the batteries included language. Well, ladies and worms, there is a metric ton of batteries. Piling them all together is probably a major risk for a lithium fire. There are over 70 built-in functions.
Can't travel on air.
Exactly. You're not taking, don't take Python on airplanes. No snakes on planes. So some of these 70 built-in functions you might use on a regular basis, and some you might not even know they're there. So I organized the course into 6 buckets. Bucket the first is on math-related functions. It starts out with the absolute value function, covers divmod, which is a way of doing division where you can get at the remainder as well, and then min and max functions. Then goes on to functions for exponents, which is kind of interesting seeing as you have an operator for that, but you also have a function for it just in case. There's rounding, which is far more complicated than your primary school teacher led you to believe, and then sums. The next bucket is on data types. Python comes with all sorts of functions to convert back and forth between different kinds of numbers and different formats. You're probably familiar with int and float, but did you know you can do complex numbers? Well, of course you did, because we've talked about it on the show before and you're a listener. So
right.
If you've been paying attention. The next group is the data type bucket, and this is a very large bucket. It starts out with functions for strings. Python has 2 common ways of converting objects to strings, the str function and the repr function. The course covers those and how they're related to their dunder equivalents inside of classes. There are also functions for dealing with things down at the character level, which help you peek under the covers at, you know, Unicode code points and that kind of stuff. The data type bucket is definitely deep. I think it might be like one of those KFC assortment buckets. It comes with those little cardboard dividers. You wouldn't want your original recipe to have relations with the extra crispy. So,
yeah.
So a nice companion for strings on the other side of this little bit of cardboard is bytes. These functions don't get used as much unless you're writing certain kinds of code, but Python wouldn't be a general purpose language without them. And then the last group in the data types bucket is about collections. So it covers lists, tuples, dicts, and both kinds of sets. The next bucket is about loops and iterables. In this section, you'll learn just what a for loop is doing and how you can unroll a loop, doing the steps by hand with the right function calls. You also learn how to do operations on iterables, like reverse them or glue several of them together with zip. The next couple of buckets are likely more familiar, dealing with printing, string formatting, getting input from command lines and files. These functions include some of the firsts that you might learn when you're starting with Python, but a lot of them are deeper than you might expect. You can do basic text animation with all the extra arguments to print. So even though print is newbie's first function, it's got layers and there's stuff in there. Python is an object-oriented language, and as such, a lot of the built-in functions are actually about that. Some of the things you might not think of as functions, like the class method decorator, actually are functions. Well, that's a generous definition of a function, but class method and property, which are decorators, are both built-ins, and they get covered. I've lost count of my buckets, and there's still a whole bunch left, including introspection, execution of strings as code, in case you feel like a self-inflicted chest wound, a bunch of miscellaneous stuff like the help system, and ways of programmatically invoking import. So this course is a beast. If you want to do a deep dive on all things built in, take a look. But I might suggest dipping your toes in a bit at a time, find a bucket and go for a dip. That's a very big bucket or a very small swimmer. Either way.
You've talked about chicken.
Yeah, that's right. This is a pool full of chickenness analogies dead, I think, is what it goes. But there's a lot of content here. And because it's grouped, you can, you know, maybe drill in on some of the stuff that you're not as familiar with.
Well, I thought we could discuss a little bit further into it. Like, it's a common thing for people to... I feel like as they move from a beginner into like these more advanced topics, that they may want to look at a course like this and say, okay, well, where does this stuff fit in?
Where are my gaps?
Yeah. And then I have another idea real quick. I wanted to mention that I feel like these things like MicroPython are trimming a lot of this out, right? To make themselves smaller. I don't know exactly how much of it.
I think they usually go after the modules rather than Instead of the built-ins. Yeah, okay. I'm not 100% sure of that, but it's usually the mod. Like, if you're doing MicroPython, you're probably not going to be doing a lot of statistics, so you could probably safely
you could take drop some of the mathematical stuff out.
Whereas dropping min and max is probably a little more problematic. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder where the lines are drawn. Something to look into the documentation. I thought I would just mention a couple things that again, people moving from beginner to advanced may want to look at. Things like Enumerate is just a really great tool for working with iterables. Range has always been one of my favorites. If you want to learn some of these just one-off, it's a great way to kind of go through it. And then as you're learning more advanced concepts inside of Python, all that stuff about introspection, I think, is good. The locals and globals, like where are these things inside the scope? Other introspection, like using ID, we do a lot of this in REPL examples to show how that works. DIR, and showing what are the different things that are attached to objects. And so, like, I find a lot of that stuff helpful, especially to have someone show you how you can use that in your own code to potentially debug things or try things out and kind of learn some of the intricacies and kind of odd things that happen in Python sometimes. So.
Well, so I was kind of curious as to, where I used what and what it looked like. So I threw together a little script, which turns out it has a whole bunch of bugs in it, but we'll get back to that in a second. What I basically just wrote a quick little scanner, and I went looking for all the built-ins in a couple different places on my hard drive that I keep code. And I wrote down a guess as to what I thought the five most likely of these would be in my code, and I wasn't very right. I would have guessed print, length, open, super, and is instance if I had to say top five of what I got used. And then that kind of brought me to the thinking of just what you were saying there, which is like three that I use all the time, but will not show up in my code is because I use them when I'm debugging and then I'm in the REPL or I'm in a breakout session.
Right.
And that would be DIR, VARs, and ID, right? So though it's kind of interesting that there's these three things that I use all the time that will not show up in this scanner at all. But anyway, so then I ran, my guess was print, len, open, super, and is instance.
Yeah.
And then I ran the scanner, and the top five in my main directory where I keep most of my code were int with 7,000 instances,
wow,
print with 5,000 instances, len with 3,400 instances, is instance with 2,300 instances, and all with just over 2,000.
Okay.
And the int thing was very, very surprising to me. And I thought maybe it's because one of the things that you do in the web a lot is everything comes in text and you have to convert it into what it's supposed to be. And then I realized my scanner isn't very smart and print ends with int. And double counting.
Got extra ints in there.
So I think there's actually only about 2,000 ints, which is still far more than I expected because I think my int is double counting with my print. But when I subtract that, it still would show up in the top seven or eight. So that was a bit surprising. And the other one that was surprising was all, because I almost never use that. But the place I was running has a bunch of code that I check out when I fork off of GitHub.
Okay.
So I think that all is getting kicked in from other people's code.
Okay.
So this just comes down to, this is a random collection, but those were the top five. Not surprisingly, the bottom five were Anext, which is a asynchronous mechanism for loop unrolling. ASCII, which you shouldn't be using at all because we use Unicode now. Class method, which surprised me a little bit, but I guess that's not as much object-oriented code in there as needed, or we don't use class methods as much. Breakpoint, which makes sense because you shouldn't be leaving those in there. And I'm now wondering where those three are, and I want to make sure they're not in my code.
That's something to check for, I guess.
Because right? That means something's going to die in production. And then the last one, which makes sense to me, is memory view. And that's a way of looking at how, for particular kinds of objects, you can look at how things are mapped out in memory. And that's a very, very specific use case. And I think, I'm not 100% sure, I'd have to check it, but I think the usage of that was from a course which actually taught how to use it. So, I think that one instance of that. So then I reran the script and I did it just on the code that I have written for real Python courses. Hmm. To sort of see whether or not it changed. And it did. I have my int and print up top, but now int has basically gone away if I subtract the print from it. So, but then I've got iter, which kind of surprised me. And again, that's because we've written a bunch of courses on it.
Now you've done a whole bunch of iterator stuff.
Yeah. And len, which makes sense, and then range. Interestingly, inside of the real Python code, help doesn't show up at all. Oct doesn't show up at all. And static method don't show up at all. So,
all right. Got to do some other courses.
Evidently, yes.
That's great. It's time to shine a spotlight on another Real Python video course. Python's built-in functions are predefined functions you can use anywhere in your code without any imports. They handle common tasks across math, data type creation, iterable processing, and input and output. And this video course is titled Exploring Python's Built-in Functions. It's based on a tutorial by Leodonis Pozo Ramos. And for the video course, your instructor is my co-host, Christopher Trudeau. And he's going to take you through how to recognize Python's built-in functions and the built-in scope they live in, how to use the right built-in for tasks involving math, data types, iterables, and I/O. Distinguishing real functions from classes that only look like them, and applying built-ins to solve practical problems with less code for you to write yourself. I think it's a worthy investment of your time to learn which functions to reach for and that make your code effective and more Pythonic. Real Python video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. And like most of the recent courses on Real Python, there are exercises woven into the path through the course to test your knowledge. Check out the video course. You can find the link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. I'm ready to dig into projects. And I have two really simple ones today. They're actually cheat sheets, which I'm a fan of. Again, I think beginners find this stuff handy, but there's one that I think is just really well done. It's by friend of the show, Al Swigert. And I saw this on Blue Sky. He had shared it. In this particular one, he created a resource. It's called Python. I don't know if you would even pronounce it, but STRF time and STRP time. Directive cheat sheet. So they basically have to do with these directives that are for formatting or pulling information out of date and time objects or date time objects. Really show some nice functionality, which I also I'll get into. So the directives have a percent sign and a lowercase or uppercase letter that are used in the arguments for, again, date time dot strf time or date time, STRP time. The F is for formatting and the P is for stripping the information out.
Parsing.
Yeah, parsing versus formatting. I have a question for you. How many do you think there are?
Oh, I know it's a lot.
Yeah, it's 22.
Yeah, because this maps directly to similar functionality in C and it's crazy.
Yeah. Is that where all this is coming from pretty much?
Yeah.
It is C Python, so there is one more, 23, which is if you want to have an actual percent sign, you have to do %%. So an example would be percent and the lowercase a, which would show a weekday as the locale's abbreviation. So MON for Monday or TUE for Tuesday or what have you. And then percent capital A would be the weekday's full name and locale's abbreviation. Again, locale meaning it could be anywhere in the world. So those might be spelled very differently depending on the language. Percent lowercase d is day of the month with a zero padded number. So like if it's the third day, 03. And a couple I didn't know, like a couple of those I've used, you know, and maybe you've had to look these things up before, but percent lowercase x is the locale's appropriate date representation. So you can just type that. And if you were in Canada, it would look different than it would look in the US for the date representation. And then percent capital X is that for time. So if you wanted to do like a pretty straightforward date and time for your locale, you could do percent X, lowercase x, and percent capital X. Anyway, the page has a feature that I really like also, along with all of those things explained out. It has a live output field that you can just type into and it'll show the formatting. So you can just go in there and try some of them out and see how you'd like it to look, how you want it to be formatted. And you can put in like colons inside there. You can put in commas and other things, again, depending on how you want it to format. And then, of course, the reverse isn't, that's not in the field. You should make another field for parsing, in my opinion. And that would be kind of cool, but has all the stuff for that too. So it's a handy resource. I think I would probably use this in the future because, you know, you can go, he has links to the docs inside of, you know, Python, the actual Python documentation for formatting and parsing. The second is from friend of the show, Rodrigo, and it's an iterTools cheat sheet. The cheat sheet contains diagrams that explain how the iterables from the module iterTools work in a very visual way. He's got five categories. He has a sixth one, but I'll mention that. The first is reshaping. So like is slice, group by, batched and chain, and other stuff like that. Filtering. So you have like filter, filter false, take while, drop while, infinite things. Like there's a repeat and a cycle and count, which are interesting iterable things that are in there. Complementary stuff, zip and zip longest, map, star map, reduce, if you've played with some of these things. And understanding visually how they look, he's using like little squares and triangles and colors and stuff like that to kind of give you a quick idea of like, how would this look as far as working? And the last one is combinatorial. So that would be like product, permutations, combinations. He has a bonus one called T, T-E-E. iterTools has 19 iterables and one function, T. T forks an iterable into independent iterators. I think you might have to read a little more and dig into that. He put it up as a printable, like really well-formatted true cheat sheet that if you wanted to, you know, print it out yourself in light or dark mode and different resolutions. He has them on sale at Gumroad. So caveat there, you can pay a nominal fee or you can set the price to zero. I think it just asks for an email address, but I think it's a handy tool if you're looking for it. And I'm a big fan of cheat sheets. We have some from Real Python. I might include a couple more for you there also. Are you a cheat sheet person at all? You ever use those?
I used to when I was coding a lot.
Yeah.
Right? Like things like the date, time, whatever, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I find the advent of Google has meant I just re-Google it. I end up in the same place. There is one resource I go back to religiously. I'm not sure if it qualifies as a cheat sheet, but there's one which is a listing of when something got added to Python.
Oh, yeah. You've mentioned it before.
Yeah, it's called What's in Which Python by Ned Batchelder.
Yeah.
You know, that's probably very me specific because I go to write a course or write an article and you know, I'm like, oh, when is this?
Right.
What is the minimum version you need to be able to practice with this? So that one I find is something that I go back to that is kind of a cheat sheety sort of resource. But
yeah, cool.
Yeah.
What do you got for a project?
My project this week is a project built on top of a project. So nested hats.
There you go.
It's by friend of the show, Adam Johnson, and it's called Django or JSON. Before I get to that, let me peel the onion. I must have been hungry when I wrote all my notes. I've got buckets of chicken. I got onions. Now I have a sudden desire for dessert. I don't know. Anyways, the inner project is called OrJSON, and it's by GitHub user IJL. Not sure if I'm supposed to pronounce that or read the letters. The library is a drop-in replacement for Python's JSON module. It's written in Rust, and as such is significantly faster. It boasts a 10x improvement on serialization and a 2x improvement on deserialization. So if you're doing a lot with JSON data, this library in its own right is worth taking a look at. And one of those places that you deal with JSON a lot is the web, especially if you're building APIs.
Yeah.
So Adam is a Django guy, and he did exactly what you'd expect a Django guy to do with OrJSON. He built a Django wrapper for it. So there are classes and functions that use JSON inside of Django, but there isn't an easy way to replace the JSON library in these situations. So Adam's code re-implements the common calls using OrJSON instead of the Python library. So for example, if you want to return JSON from an API view in Django, you would normally create a JSON response object. Adam's library has a new one of those based on OrJSON instead of the system one. This work has also resulted in a new Django proposal, making the interface to JSON be a pluggable backend. I believe Flask does that already. So this would mean you could swap the engine out. So this would actually be pretty cool, because not only would you be able to use something like OrJSON to get some speed up, but you in theory could use fancier JSONs like JSON-C, which allows things like comments and other things with the right implementation. Until that day arrives, though, you've got Django OrJSON as a stopgap. So thanks, Adam.
Yeah, the installation I was wondering about. And I was like, okay, yeah, you'd put it into the installed apps inside your Django project.
Yeah, you just basically import from, for example, that JSON response that I was talking about is in Django.http. So you would import it from Django underscore or JSON.http instead. So he's mapped it all. So that really is just replace the word Django with Django or JSON and you'll get it.
Yeah. Anything to speed it up. That's good. Well, thanks for bringing all these PyCoders goodies this week, Christopher.
Now for my outro song.
Oh, we'll see. It took a whole half an hour, 45 minutes to make that thing. Come on.
There you go.
Maybe next week. Or next time. All right. Talk to you soon.
Cheers.
And don't forget, try out HydraDB for free and start building ontology-aware agents. One API for all your AI memory and context use cases at hydradb.com/signup. I want to say thanks to Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.